her name. I ask a young woman, why are you crying? I stand in front of Vincent's self-portrait. Vincent, who knew pain and failure, who knew self-doubt and insanity, who cut off his ear, who shot himself. I know Vincent well. I have nothing to say to him. I leave the museum at closing time. I walk back to the hotel, stopping along the way to get warm. When I arrive, I wait in the lobby. 5 minutes later, Leonard and Snapper step out of an elevator, start walking toward me. I stand, meet them halfway. Leonard speaks.
My son.
What's up? Snapper speaks.
How you doing, kid?
Good. Leonard speaks.
Ready for some basketball?
Yeah.
Good.
We leave, go downstairs, pick up the car, drive to the stadium. The stadium is old and decrepit. It was built in the 1920s and is scheduled to be destroyed this summer, replaced by a newer version being built across the street. When we arrive, we pull through rusted gates to an area of guarded parking, the parking lot where the players and team owners park. We get out of the car, walk into the stadium through a guarded door. We enter a series of tunnels beneath the main seating area of the stadium. We walk past locker rooms, training areas, administrative offices. We walk past men and women in uniforms rushing around. I have no idea what they do. We walk out of a tunnel and onto the court. It's near game time and the stadium is almost full. The game, as all Chicago basketball games are, is sold out. Leonard pulls 3 tickets from the inside pocket of his jacket, hands one to me, one to Snapper. He walks along the edge of the court. We follow him. He stops at 3 seats near the center, motions for us to sit. 5 minutes later, the lights go out. Loud music starts blaring through speakers hanging from the ceiling. The Chicago team is introduced and runs to their bench. The opposing team, which is from New York, enters without fanfare. Everyone stands while the national anthem is played. The game starts with the tip-off. Chicago's team is the reigning champion, and their star player is considered the best basketball player in the world. New York can't keep up, and they get obliterated. At halftime, Chicago leads by 18. They win the game by 30. Leonard acts like a little kid throughout, cheering, laughing, jumping up and down, eating popcorn, hot dogs, and ice cream bars, drinking large cola after large cola after large cola. I skip the popcorn and hot dogs. I eat 8 ice cream bars and drink 7 large colas. Snapper doesn't eat anything, says he's watching his figure and waiting for dinner. After the game, we go to a restaurant. It's a simple Italian restaurant on the west side of the city, not far from the stadium. We walk in and Leonard and Snapper greet the owner, who leads us into a room behind the main dining room. The room has a long, simple table covered with a white tablecloth. There are 10 chairs around it. We sit and the owner asks what we would like to drink. Colas for Leonard and me, a glass of red wine for Snapper. Leonard looks at me, speaks.
You give notice today?
I shake my head. Nope.
Why not?
Spent the day in a museum. Snapper speaks.
What'd you see?
All kinds of stuff. Leonard speaks.
Get more specific, my son.
Do you know anything about art? Leonard looks at Snapper.
Do we know anything about art?
Quite a bit, actually.
Leonard turns to me.
We know quite a bit.
I laugh.
How?
How? We read. We go to museums and galleries. We pay attention.
I would have never thought. Snapper speaks.
Tell him how we got into it.
Leonard speaks.
I have a house on the beach outside of L.A. Every summer the town puts on this thing called the Pageant of the Masters.
Snapper speaks.
I love the Pageant of the Masters.
Leonard nods.
What they do is make stage sets that look actually like famous paintings. So let's say they were doing The Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci. They'd get a bunch of men, dress them up so they look exactly like the apostles in the painting. They get another fella and make him look like the Jesus in the painting. They put everyone at a table that looked like the table in the painting in a room that looked exactly like the room in the painting. Then they pose in painting poses and they sit there.
Snapper speaks.
It's beautiful.
Leonard speaks. And tons of people come see the paintings, which have now been brought to life.
Snapper speaks.
They look so real, it's crazy.
Leonard speaks. We've been going every summer for years.
Snapper speaks.
And every summer it gets better and better.
Leonard speaks. We're knowledgeable about everything from pre-Renaissance work to post-impressionists.
Snapper speaks.
They don't do modern art very well. Too hard to break a real person down into some form of cubism, pure abstraction, or minimalism.
Leonard speaks.
They do Matisse and Modigliani. Don't forget about them.
Snapper speaks.
I shouldn't have forgotten Matisse, but Modigliani is boring.
Leonard speaks.
His work is not as dynamic as some.
Snapper speaks.
It's boring. Fucking boring.
Leonard turns to me.
What do you think, my son?
About Modigliani or this conversation?
Both.
I like Modigliani. I think those women are weird and gorgeous. I'm sort of shocked by the conversation.
Everybody thinks we're barbarians, but we've got soft, sensitive, sophisticated sides to us.
Snapper speaks.
I'm very soft, sensitive, and sophisticated.
I laugh.
The door opens. Waiters start bringing in food. Platters of antipasti, mozzarella and tomato, fried calamari, fried zucchini, zuppa di clams,
Caesar salad, crostini with chopped liver. There is more food than the three of us could eat. I ask Leonard if he's expecting anyone else. He tells me that there may be a few people stopping by to say hello. We start eating. The smell of the food on the table and the smells drifting into the room from the nearby kitchen, garlic, oregano, olive oil, peppers, parmesan pesto, roasting chicken, beef and veal, sautéed spinach and scampi, strong espresso and chocolate, ignite my hunger. I start eating. I eat slowly, one thing at a time. Though the addict in me and the alcoholic in me say, go, 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 more, more, more. As we eat, we talk. Talk about the game we just saw. Leonard and Snapper debate the merits of this restaurant against Italian restaurants in Manhattan and the Bronx. As we finish the first course, the door opens and two men step into the room. Both are large, thick, menacing men with short hair, simple dark suits. Leonard and Snapper rise, greet them, introduce them to me. Both slip me cards when we shake hands, which I slip into my pocket. I'm curious to know what the cards are, what they say, who these men are, but I know I should wait. Look at them later. If they wanted me to look at them now, they would have handed them to me, not slipped them to me. As more food arrives, large platters of food, spaghetti with meatballs, linguine with clam sauce, penne, rigatoni, pappardelle, chicken scarpariello, chicken contadino, chicken cacciatore, veal cutlets, chops, veal saltimbocca, ossobuco, lobster oreganato, scampi fra diavolo. More people arrive. The table is filled. There are people standing around the table in every corner of the room. I meet men, some obviously Italian, some not, all wearing dark suits and wedding rings. I get slipped card after card. I meet women, all beautiful, some with the men. None wear wedding rings. I get slipped a couple of phone numbers. There are handshakes, kisses on cheeks, back slaps, laughter, laughter, laughter. There are cigars, cigarettes, red wine, white wine, beer, cocktails, colas for me. I love an ice-cold cola. Leonard and Snapper are having a great time, laughing and happy. When I'm not talking to someone, I'm watching them. Leonard commands the room. Everyone is aware of his presence when he talks to them. They listen as he moves from person to person, group to group. The attention is always focused on him. Hours pass, quickly pass. It's late. The room is still crowded. I'm full, tired, wired on caffeine and nicotine. My clothes smell like deep, strong cigars. My shirt has stains on it, grease and tomato sauce. My pocket is full of cards. I tell Leonard I'm going home. I feel like I can sleep. He walks me outside. I speak. You have a lot of friends, Leonard.
Most of these people were there to meet you.
Why?
You ask them what they do for a living?
No.
You look at those cards they gave you?
No.
look at them when you get home.
Why?
Every card you got tonight is more or less a get-out-of-jail-free card. You come work for me and nothing is going to happen to you. Every person in there will guarantee it.
I laugh. You're not going to stop, are you?
Not until you stop working at the bar.
I'll give notice tomorrow. Leonard smiles.
Ha ha! That's great news.
I laugh.
We don't use contracts, but I'm going to give you a signing bonus.
I laugh again. He reaches into a pocket, pulls out a wad of rolled cash held together by a rubber band. He hands it to me. I can't take this, Leonard.
Sure you can, and you're gonna.
No way. This is a ton of dough. I haven't done shit to earn it.
So what? Take it. It's your starting up money.
No. I hold the cash toward him. He shakes his head.
We've been through this before, my son.
What?
When someone wants to do something nice for you, don't argue. Don't resist. Don't say no. Don't try to change their mind. Just smile and say thank you and think about how fortunate you are to have generous people in your life.
That's a lot of fucking money, Leonard.
Just smile and say thank you.
I put the cash in my pocket. Thank you, Leonard.
It's good to have you. Great to have you.
I laugh. I need to go home.
Hold on.
He walks to a black car, sitting on the curb, knocks on the window. The window rolls down, he speaks to the driver, shakes his hand, turns to me.
You have a ride.
I walk to the car. Thanks for the game, dinner, the cash.
That's your signing bonus. You're gonna earn it.
I laugh. Yeah.
Since I got you to quit and take a real job, I'll be leaving in the morning.
Safe travels.
Thank you.
When do I start?
Not sure. Somebody will come see you.
And they'll also tell me what I'm supposed to do?
Yeah.
Cool.
See you soon, my son.
Thanks for everything, Leonard. He nods. I get in the back seat of the car. I go home. My mother comes to visit. My parents live in Tokyo, and I don't see them very often. They are responsible for getting me into the treatment center. I haven't always liked them, and I have hurt them over and over and over through the course of my life, but they have always loved me. I am lucky to have them. My mother sees my apartment, laughs. She asks me where I sleep, where I sit. I tell her the floor. She shakes her head and says, "Not good, James, not good." She calls someone in Michigan, which is where they used to live. They still have a house. It sits empty now. She asks the person about furniture and storage, how easy it is to access. She asks if they can send me a bed and a desk and a table. She hangs up, says I'll have a bed and a desk and a table in a few days. We go downtown. We walk down Michigan Avenue. My mother and father are both from suburban Chicago, met here, were married here. They didn't have any money when they were married. They spent their honeymoon in a downtown hotel. As we walk, my mother points out restaurants they went to, parks where they sat, held hands, kissed. Stores where they wandered, looking at things they couldn't afford, hoping someday, someday. It's nice to hear her memories. I like that she's sharing them with me. It feels like a door opening. A door to her, to my father, to their life. It's a door that I have never acknowledged before, a door that I'm happy to step through, a door I'm fortunate to have still be open. We go to lunch. A fancy place. A place my mother knows and loves. She tries to eat there every time she's in town. We wait for a table, sit, napkins on lap, glasses of water. My mom starts asking me questions. How are you doing? I'm okay. How are you feeling? Depends. I go up and down. Way up and way down. Mostly I'm down. Is it hard staying sober? Yeah, it is. Every second of every day is a struggle. I know I'll die if I do it. Sometimes I feel like I want to die. Do you need help? No, I'll get through it. I gotta believe I'll get through it. She asks about Lily. I just shake my head. She asks what happened. I just shake my head.
say it didn't work out. I don't want to talk about it. Can't talk about it. She says that's too bad. I had hoped that would work out for you. I cannot respond. As we finish our meal, someone approaches our table. I vaguely recognize the person, but can't place him. James? Yeah? David! From school! I still can't place him. Pretend. Yeah! How you doing? Good! What are you doing here? This is my mom. We're eating lunch. He looks at my mom. Nice to meet you. Mom speaks. You too. He looks back at me. I'm surprised to see you because I heard you were in prison for popping some cop. My mom cringes. Where'd you hear that? I'm not sure. As you can see, I'm not. I guess. You live in here now? Yeah. You want to get together sometime? Sure. He reaches into his pocket, draws out his wallet. You still partying? I shake my head. No. He takes a card from his wallet, hands it to me. If you ever get the urge, call me. Will do. See you later. Yeah. He walks away. I look at my mom. She speaks. I hope you never call him. I won't. He seems like an asshole. I laugh. My mom has never spoken like that around me. I have no idea who he is. I know I went to school with him, but other than that, nothing. Good. He's an asshole. I laugh again. We finish, leave, walk some more. My mom shares more of her memories. I listen, walk further through the door. We see the hotel where they spent their wedding night, a pizza place that my grandfather loved, a department store where my grandmother liked to buy presents. We see a jersey from the Chicago hockey team. My parents went to one of the team's games the night after they were married. They couldn't afford to do anything else. It was a big evening for them. It starts to get dark, close to the time my mom will leave. Before she leaves, she wants to buy me some plates, forks, spoons, knives. Right now I use paper and plastic that I get from takeout restaurants. She thinks having normal possessions like plates, forks, spoons, knives will help normalize my existence, help me adjust more easily. We go to a store, look around. Everything I like is black. My mom laughs, thinks it's strange that I like black plates and black utensils. I tell her that as much as she wants me to normalize, there are some parts of me that will always be a bit off. She laughs. We get all the beautiful, semi-normal, black items. We go back to my apartment, put everything in the cabinets above my sink. My mom has a car coming to pick her up, take her to the airport. She says she needs to go. I thank her for the day, a great day, probably the best day I have ever had with her. She smiles, starts to cry. She's happy. Happy I'm alive. Happy I'm becoming human. Happy we can spend a day together without screaming. I give her a hug, walk her out, open the car door for her. The car pulls away. I meet a man underneath the train tracks. He calls himself a ragamuffin, the Ragamuffin King. He says he wanders the world looking for rags, beautiful rags, magnificent rags. I bow to him, the Ragamuffin King. I go to coffee with Mickey. I am the only straight man in the coffee shop. Mickey introduces me to his friends as his hetero buddy, James. Mickey has a new boyfriend, an attorney who says he loves him, loves his paintings, wants him to do whatever he wants, just be happy. And he is. Mickey is happy. I meet a man at a bar while I'm waiting for my friends. He says he's 45. He looks like he's 25. I ask him if he has a secret. He says never get angry and be as immature as you can for as long as you can get away with it. A man sitting next to him laughs and says that's bullshit. The great secret is eat food and drink beer till you drop. I see an old friend. He and I used to drink together, do drugs together. Deal drugs together. He cleaned up for a girl, a girl he lives with now, a girl he loves, a girl he wants to marry. We laugh about old times, good times, bad times. He got out before they got really bad. We go to a punk show at an old abandoned bowling alley. The band plays on one of the neglected lanes. They're young and loud, and they can't play their instruments, and the songs are awful, and they look like they're having a great time. We move into the pit, the fray, the moving circle of young, angry men in black jackets and combat boots, throwing elbows, high-stepping and slamming into each other. We get hit, we fall, we get knocked around a bit. It's fun every now and then, getting knocked around a bit. I meet a third man. He's an old man. He trips in the street. He falls, and I help him up, walk him to the curb. He shakes my hand, says, "Keep the faith, young man." I ask him what that means. He says, "Keep running and don't let them catch you." I sleep during the day. I still dream about drinking and drugs. Sometimes I wake to a hangover. Sometimes I wake to a trickle of blood from my nose. Sometimes I wake scared and shaking. I read, go to museums, and visit Lily in the afternoon. Sometimes I read to her. Sometimes I talk to her. Sometimes I just sit and remember the times. Remember the times. Remember the times. I go out at night, go to bars with my friends. I drink cola, smoke cigarettes, shoot pool, talk, sometimes don't talk, just sit and watch. I start to laugh more and more easily, start to feel more comfortable. When the bars close, I walk randomly through the empty city, walk among the buildings, through parks, along the lake. I sit on benches. The wind and cold hurt me, numb me. I stop feeling. There is peace in pain so overwhelming that it shuts down all feeling. It is the only peace I know. I go back to my apartment. Sleep. Dream. It's morning. The phone rings. A man, a voice I don't know, tells me to meet him at a local diner. I walk to the diner, sit at a booth, drink coffee. Wait. A man walks into the diner. He's in his late 20s, clean-shaven, dark hair, well-dressed, but not flashy. A gold watch. He stops in front of my booth, speaks. "Your name James?" "Yeah." He sits down across from me. "You got a good memory?" "Yeah." "You better." "Why?" "This is how it's gonna work." He reaches into his pocket, pulls out a small pager, pushes it across the table. "Keep the pager on you at all times. You'll get a page, call the number. Always use a payphone, don't use the same one more than twice. When you call, you'll speak to someone who'll give you instructions. Never write those instructions down, keep absolutely no record of them. If you fuck them up, it'll be your problem, so make sure you've got them before you hang up. When you do hang up, memorize the number on the pager. Delete the number, follow the instructions. If you're driving, drive 3 miles over the speed limit, never faster, never slower. Always check the car to make sure all the lights are working. If you get pulled over, don't say a fucking word. Ask for a lawyer and wait. Tell the lawyer to get in touch with your friend Leonard. If the job goes well, and if you don't fuck it up, when the job is done, call the original number to confirm. If you ever get a page that says 911, immediately stop whatever you're doing. Take whatever you're moving and put it in a safe place that is not your home. If it's a car, put it in a secure lot. If you get a page that says 411, stop whatever you're doing and wait for further instructions. Any questions?" "No." "Do you want me to repeat what I just told you?" "No." "Have a nice day." The man stands and leaves. I order more coffee, some eggs, bacon and toast. I smoke a cigarette, read the paper, wait for the food. It arrives, I start eating, the pager goes off. 2 loud, piercing beeps. 2 more. 2 more. I stand, pick up the pager, walk to the payphone in the back of the diner. I drop in my coins, dial the number. There's a male voice after 1 ring. "Hello." "I got paged?" "First timer?" "Yeah." "You got a pen?" "No, no pen." "Good." "Good memory?" "Yeah." "You better." Voice gives me an address in a nearby suburb. tells me to knock on the door, I will be handed a suitcase. Put the suitcase in the trunk of a white car sitting in the driveway. The keys are under the driver's side floor mat. I am given a second address, which is in Milwaukee. Drive the car to the Milwaukee address, remove the suitcase from the trunk. Knock on the door, ask for a man named Paul. Give him the suitcase. Don't give it to anyone else. Paul is waiting for it. Drive the car back to the suburban Chicago address, leave it in the driveway, keys under the mat. Call to confirm. I have the voice repeat both addresses. He asks me if I need them again. I tell him no, I got it. He says good, hangs up on me. I hang up, return to my booth, finish my breakfast, leave. I take a commuter train north into the moneyed suburbs of Chicago. It's late morning. The train is almost empty. I'm nervous. My heart is racing, hands slightly shaking. I stare out the window, try to take deep breaths, try to stay calm. The few other passengers I see all look like FBI agents, middle-aged men in dark suits, and they all appear to be glancing at me, watching me. I tell myself that's bullshit, that I'm being paranoid, that nobody here gives a shit why I'm on this train, but I don't feel any better. Arrest scenarios roll through my mind. I can see the cuffs, feel them on my skin, hear the cop reciting Miranda, smell the back of the car, feel a slight breeze as the door slams shut. I can imagine sitting with a lawyer, discussing my case, debating the merits of a plea agreement, trying to figure out ways to bring my sentence down. I can remember being processed, putting my few meager belongings into an envelope, changing into a jumpsuit, donning shackles, rambling down concrete and steel halls. My cell awaits me. I'm fucking nervous. The train arrives at my stop. I get off. There are a couple of cabs waiting. I get inside one of them. Give the cabbie the street name. He drives. We move through quiet neighborhoods full of large houses with wide lawns, manicured bushes, alarm system signs, foreign cars in the driveway. I have him drop me on a corner. I start looking at the tastefully mounted numbers on porches and doors. I find my way to a large stone house with a white car in the driveway. I walk to the door, knock, wait. My heart is pounding. The door opens. It's a middle-aged man wearing silk pajamas. He does have a suitcase. He speaks. "Can I help you? I'm here to pick something up." "What?" I wasn't told what. "You sure you got the right address?" My hands start shaking. "Yeah, I'm sure." I start to panic. "I don't think you do." Panic. "This is the address I was given." Panic. "By who?" "I'm not at liberty to say." "That sounds awfully strange. You come to my door to pick something up, but you don't know what it is, and you won't tell me who sent you?"
"I'm just following directions."
"Do you want me to call the police?"
"No, sir. They come quick in this town." "There's no need to call the police, sir. I must have made a mistake. I'll leave." I turn, start walking away. Can't run, too obvious. I've got to get out of here now. How the fuck did I fuck this up? I've got to get out of here now, now, now.
"Kid!"
I stop, turn around.
"I'm just fucking with you. I heard you were new, and thought I'd have some fun."
I smile. Not because I think it's funny. If I could, I'd hit this motherfucker. But because I'm relieved, and the smile is a nervous reaction. I walk back to the door. The man reaches behind and sets a battered brown suitcase in front of me.
"You scared the shit out of me."
"I couldn't tell."
"You did."
"You handled yourself well. Stayed cool. No panic. If this ever happens for real, do exactly the same thing."
"I hope it never happens."
"Don't fuck up, and it won't."
I pick up the suitcase.
"Have a nice day."
"You too." I turn, walk toward the car. The suitcase is heavy, heavier than I expected. 50 pounds, maybe 60. I hear the man shut the door behind me. I open the driver's door of the car, reach under the mat for the keys, find them. I put the suitcase in the trunk, get behind the wheel. As I pull out of the driveway, I see the man is standing at one of his windows. He's smiling, waving at me. I know the highway is to the west. I start driving west. I take the map out of the glove compartment, look at it. Interstate 94 takes me straight up. If I keep going where I'm going, I'll run into it. I set down the map, light a cigarette, settle in for the ride. The ride is easy, boring. I smoke cigarettes, listen to the radio, occasionally sing along to a cheesy love song or a heavy metal power ballad or one of the many classic rock anthems. I try to find a station that plays punk, so I can yell and scream and shout obscenities, but I can't find one. Every 15 minutes or so, I shout obscenities anyway. I see Milwaukee in the distance. It's a small city, an old city, one that hasn't experienced any form of renewal. When I was a kid, I used to watch a TV show about two women who worked in a beer factory in Milwaukee. Aside from that, I don't know shit about it. I pull off the highway, look for a gas station. I pull in, ask for directions, get them, start driving again, find the address. It is another beautiful neighborhood, huge houses sitting along the coast of Lake Michigan. I pull into a long driveway. A row of hedges runs along one side of it. A yard the size of a football field runs along the other side. A massive stone house sits at the end. It looks like it belongs in England, Ireland, or Scotland, not Milwaukee. I stop in front of it, get out of the car, get the suitcase, carry it to the front door. I knock and wait. I hear someone behind the door. The door cracks open. I hear a voice. I'm Paul. I cannot see a person. Leave the case and get out of here. I set the suitcase on the step. Paul tosses an envelope out. It lands at my feet. I pick it up, look inside. It's filled with cash. I leave. The drive back to Chicago is simple. Just smoke and listen to tunes and swear. I put the car back in the driveway, take the train back to the city. On the way back to my apartment, I stop at a payphone, call the original number on the pager, confirm delivery. I'm shooting pool for money. Playing against a guy named Tony, I've played him before, I lose to him every single time. I'm in good shape this time, shooting at the eight ball, he's got three to go. I'm in a bar called the Local Option. There's a front room, a back room. A bar runs along one wall of the front room. The pool table is in the back room. My friends are here. They're getting drunk. As I wait for my shot, I hear my pager go off. I tell Tony I have to make a call, ask him if he'll wait for me. He laughs, takes the money off the rail, where it's supposed to sit until someone wins. I speak. I'm getting that back next game. He laughs. We'll see. I leave the bar, walk down the street, look for a phone. I find one outside a dry cleaner. It's quiet, I can hear. I look at the pager, dial the number. It's not a number I recognize. I wait. Leonard answers.
Ha ha!
What's up, Leonard?
What's up? What's up? My son successfully completed his first mission. That's what the fuck is up.
I laugh.
How did it go? Tell me how it went.
It was easy. I picked up the case, drove it to Milwaukee and dropped it off, went home.
That's it?
That's it.
I heard they were going to have some fun with you, shake you up a bit.
Yeah, that happened. The guy who gave me the case fucked with me, pretended I was in the wrong place. Leonard laughs.
I bet you shit.
Sort of.
You meet Paul?
No.
Good. You're never supposed to actually meet anyone. That way, if something happens, you can't testify against them.
I thought you said nothing would ever happen.
It won't, it won't. I'm just saying if. If, my son, never happens.
I hope so.
And forget you ever met that old fucker in his pajamas.
How'd you know he was in his pajamas?
He never leaves his house, and he always wears pajamas. That's how I know.
He's been forgotten.
Any idea what was in the case?
Nope, and I don't want to know.
Take a guess.
No.
Come on.
No.
What do you think it weighed?
I don't know.
Guess.
50, 60 pounds.
50.
Okay.
You know $1 million in cash in $20 bills weighs 21 pounds?
I did not know that.
And a common suitcase weighs about 6.
I didn't know that either.
You learn something new every day.
Thank you for that bit of knowledge, Leonard.
You get your money?
Paul threw me the envelope. I wasn't sure it was mine because there was so much.
Hell of a lot better than $7 an hour.
I laugh. The envelope had $5,000 in it. Yeah, much better.
You did good, my son. You did good. I'm proud of you.
Thank you, Leonard.
You doing okay otherwise?
Yeah, I was shooting pool in a bar when you paged.
Well, go back. Have fun. Say hello to your friends if you're with them.
They'll be happy to hear it.
I'll come visit again soon, my son.
I'll look forward to it.
Keep up the good work.
I laugh. Thanks. I hang up, head back to the bar, lose 3 more times to Tony. I wander for a few hours, spend a few hours with Lily. I tell her about my new job. I know she wouldn't approve. She'd say you're moving too close to your old life. You gotta leave that shit behind. I tell her I know there are dangers, but I feel strong. Each day I feel stronger. Each day I don't drink or use, I am stronger. I tell her it would be different if she was around. I tell her she made her decisions, and now I'm on my own. And I will make my decisions. I take a car to St. Louis. I don't know what's in the car, if there's anything in the car. Nobody tells me and I don't ask. I drive 3 miles over the speed limit. I leave the car in a shopping mall parking lot. I move briefcases from the north side of Chicago to the south side of Chicago. I move briefcases from the south side to the north side. I ride the L train back and forth. I buy a set of nice clothing. Khakis, black leather shoes, a white Oxford, a blue sport coat. So that I look like a young, ambitious commuter. So that people think I'm a law student or an apprentice currency trader or a young executive at a large multinational corporation. All of which, in a certain ridiculous way, I am. I go back to Milwaukee, Detroit, Rockford, Illinois. Sometimes I receive envelopes, sometimes I don't. When I do, the amounts vary, as high as 5,000, as low as 500, usually somewhere around 3,000. I don't have a bank account, so I keep the cash hidden around my apartment. I put the bulk of it under my mattress. I put more in a plastic Ziploc bag and place the bag in the tank of my toilet. I put more in a Captain Crunch cereal box. I bury the bills beneath the crunchy nuggets. I put the rest in an empty box of dishwasher detergent that sits beneath my sink. I never carry much cash with me because I don't want to draw attention to myself. My friends ask me what I'm doing, ask me why I left my bar job. I tell them I left because it was too much to work in a bar, too much temptation and torture. They ask how being in bars with them is any different. I tell them when I'm working, I had to stand there. I was bored out of my skull. The boredom made me want to drink. When I'm in a bar with them, I can occupy myself, talk, laugh, shoot pool, drink cola after cola after cola, that it is easier to be distracted. I tell them in a certain way it's easier when I'm with them because I see how they act when they're drunk, and it reminds me of who I don't want to be and how I don't want to behave. They ask me how I'm making money. I tell them I don't have much and what I do have is borrowed. They ask what I'm doing with my time. I tell them I'm trying to make it pass. And that, at least, is true. Sometimes, all I want is for my time to pass. My phone rings. It is morning. I'm smoking cigarettes, staring at the fucking ceiling. I pick it up. Hello?
My son. I'm coming to town. Good times are on their way.
What's up, Leonard?
I'm up. You're up. That's what the fuck is up.
When are you coming?
This afternoon.
You want me to meet you at the airport?
Remember that steakhouse we went to with your friends?
Yeah.
Meet me there at 6 o'clock.
Okay.
And call some of your friends. See if we can meet them out after we eat.
Okay.
You want anything from Vegas?
Can you bring me a showgirl who'll make all my troubles go away?
I actually can.
I laugh. That's okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
If you change your mind, I'll be here for another hour.
Okay.
See you at 6.
Yeah. I hang up. Smoke. Stare at the fucking ceiling. The ceiling doesn't have much to say to me this morning. Can't tell me why I can't get off my bed. Can't tell me why my sorrow is starting to feel like rage. Can't tell me how I'm supposed to deal with it. Can't tell me shit. I smoke, stare, wait. 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 Nothing. Sometime in the afternoon, I get up, take a shower, pull some cash from beneath my mattress, put on my nice clothes. I call my friends, see what they're doing tonight. They're going to a pool hall bowling alley. I tell them I'll meet them around 9. I leave, start walking, it's not as cold. Spring is slowly asserting itself. It's harder to become numb. I have to walk longer, wear less. It still doesn't always work. My body has adjusted to the cold. It takes an hour to get to the restaurant. When I walk in, the host greets me, says, "Nice to see you again, sir." I ask if Leonard is here. He says, "Yes. Let me show you to his table." We walk into the restaurant. It's early, so it's almost empty. Leonard is sitting in the corner, facing out. He sees me, stands. "My son. My son. My son." I laugh. "Hello, Leonard." "Come sit. Come sit." The host guides me to the table, pulls out my chair. I sit down. I am also facing out. Host walks away. I speak. "So it's true."
"What's true?"
"Men like you never sit with your back to the door." He laughs.
"No way."
"No way what?"
"Back to the door. That's bullshit."
"Doesn't look like bullshit to me."
"I'm a people person. A motherfucking people person. I sit this way so I can see the people."
"The people?"
"Yeah, the people. I love them. That's me."
I laugh again. "Where's Snapper?"
"I left him at home."
"Why?"
"This isn't a business trip. I just came to see you."
"Thanks."
"I thought it would be good to spend some time together, just us."
"That sounds cool."
"How's life?"
I laugh. "Which part of it?"
"Which part do you want to talk about?"
"I like my new job."
"I knew you would. What are you doing with all that money?"
"Hiding it."
"Under your mattress?"
"Yeah."
"In a cereal box?"
"Yeah."
"In the toilet tank?"
"Yeah."
"You probably thought you were being real sneaky."
"I did."
"Not good, my son. Everybody knows those spots."
"I also got some in a dishwasher detergent box. Keep it under the sink. You know that one?"
"No. Never heard of that one before."
"If I get robbed, at least I'll have that."
"You're not gonna get robbed. I'm gonna teach you how to deal with the cash."
"Okay." He reaches into his pocket, draws out a black leather wallet, passes it to me.
"There's an Illinois driver's license in there. It's a valid license, and it will register on the state's computers. I got a picture of you that I took at the treatment center and doctored it a bit. It looks real. I also invented a name for you."
I take the license out of the wallet, look at it. It looks real. "James Testardo?"
"Yeah. Testardo means stubborn in Italian. I thought it would be funny if you could call yourself Jimmy Testardo."
I laugh.
"Okay." "The address on the license is an empty house owned by a shell company I am very, very loosely associated with, though there is no record of the association. Go to a bank, the bigger and more anonymous the bank, the better, and get a safe deposit box. Whenever you go there, wear a hat or sunglasses or something that slightly alters your appearance. Put your money in the account, and put it in slowly and in manageable amounts, 3, 4, 5,000 at a time. Never approach 10,000, because at 10,000 the bank is required to notify the IRS of the deposit. Once it's in there, take it out in cash as need be. Don't pay your bills with checks. Always use money orders purchased with cash. If you start to accumulate too much, go buy something expensive, something in the 3, 4, 5,000 range. Buy it with a credit card. If you don't have one, I can get one for you. In the Testardo name, if you want it that way. Pay the credit card off in several installments using money orders purchased with cash. When you do buy something, I would advise buying small things, like watches or art or silver, jewelry, rare books, and don't go showing it off to people. Buy things you can sell for cash if you're ever in a jam. That can be moved quickly and easily. Use common sense and don't draw attention to yourself and you'll be fine.
I think I can handle that.
I know you can. You got any questions?
No.
You want to order?
Sure. Leonard motions for the waiter. We order lobsters and fillets, creamed spinach and baked potatoes. We drink water, I drink cola, Leonard drinks diet cola. We talk about the upcoming baseball season, talk about our friends from the treatment center. One was a fugitive. He was caught and sentenced to life in prison, no parole. Another was beaten to death outside of a bar. A third is missing. A fourth committed suicide by shotgun. A few are still okay, still holding on, still struggling. I tell Leonard I spoke with our friend Miles, who is a federal judge in New Orleans. He's still clean, feeling strong, taking care of himself. He's happy to be home, reunited with his wife and children, who he feared he might lose because of his alcoholism. Leonard smiles. Asks me to tell Miles hello. He says he likes Miles. Wishes he could stay in touch with him, but their respective positions prevent any sort of significant relationship. Our food arrives. We eat. I ask Leonard about his ongoing quest to play golf on the Connecticut course where his father worked. He laughs. It's a bitter laugh, a laugh that masks anger and pain. He says no luck. I say sorry. He shrugs, says that's the way the world works, that people with privilege guard their privilege, that people take care of their own kind, that there are certain institutions that are exclusive whether it is right or not. He says it works the same way with his own organization, that only Italians can be full members, that there are no exceptions. I ask him what he's going to do. He laughs again. The laugh different now, anger mixed with menace. He says country club members do not take blood oaths, that there are certainly some that misbehave, cheat on their wives, sleep with whores, run up gambling debts. He is going to find one of them and have a conversation with that person, and he will get in and play the course, just as his dying father made him promise he would. We finish. Our food is taken away. Leonard suggests we go to the bar for coffee and cigars. We stand. As we walk away from the table, he motions to the host, who walk into the bar, settle into two large, plush, comfortable chairs. The host follows, speaks to the bartender, who walks into the bar's humidor. The bartender returns, hands the host a small box. The host walks toward us, opens the box, speaks.
Would you like a Cuban cigar?
Leonard smiles.
Matter of fact, I would. Thank you.
Leonard reaches into the box, chooses two cigars, the host walks away. Leonard takes a cutter from his jacket, carefully cuts the cigars, hands one to me, lights them.
You remember how to smoke?
Yeah. I take a drag, swallow. The tobacco is sweet, strong. My mouth is immediately overwhelmed by it. I prefer cigarette tobacco. Leonard speaks.
These are good.
If you say so.
If you ever smoke a shitty one, you'll be able to tell the difference.
I only smoke them with you.
Then you'll never smoke a shitty one.
Without having ordered it, coffee arrives. I take a sip. It's hot. Strong. I feel it immediately. My heart starts racing.
Time for the serious talk, my son.
What's the serious talk?
I want to know how you're doing.
I'm doing fine.
What's that mean?
I don't know.
So you're not fine?
No, all things considered, I think I'm better than fine. Much better than fine.
Explain.
I'm holding on, getting through the days, feeling stronger, feeling more comfortable with myself. I don't know how I'm doing it, really, but I am. And each day is a step toward some form of normalcy and security, a step toward having a real life. If I was in hell before, I'm in purgatory now. And I feel like I can get to whatever's next. I still can't sleep right. I still have cravings all day, every fucking day. I'm still nervous around and uncomfortable around people. And I still feel scared sometimes. But I'm okay with all of it. I've accepted that all this shit is just part of the price of my former life.
What are you scared of?
I don't know.
Yes, you do.
When you've spent your whole life drinking and doing drugs, you learn how to do everything in a fucked up way. I'm having to learn how to do everything over, and sometimes it's scary, and most of the time I feel scared.
If it makes you feel any better, I'm scared all the time, too.
I laugh. A big old tough guy like you? I don't believe it.
I used to think I was tough, but I've realized I wasn't. I was fragile, and I wore thick fucking armor, and I hurt people so they couldn't hurt me, and I thought that was what being tough was. But it isn't. What we're doing now is tough. Rebuilding. Changing. Having to deal with the damage. Having to face the fear. If I make it through, then you can call me fucking tough.
You'll make it through.
We both will.
We'll see.
How are you doing with your loss?
I miss her.
Did you think you wouldn't?
No, but I didn't think I would either, because I didn't think this was gonna happen. I was prepared for something else.
But it did.
Yeah, it did, and it fucking sucks, and I miss her.
What do you miss?
I miss everything. I miss talking to her, hearing about her day. I miss her voice all gravelly and smoky. I miss hearing her laugh. I miss getting her letters, writing her letters. I miss her eyes and the smell of her hair and the way her breath tasted. I fucking miss everything. I miss knowing she was around because it helped me to know that she was around, that someone like her existed. I guess most of all, I miss knowing I would see her again. I always thought I'd see her again.
You've gotta respect what she did, and that'll help you.
I don't know why the fuck you keep saying that.
It's true.
That's fucking crazy.
No, it's not.
She killed herself, Leonard. Threw in the fucking towel. And I feel sadness and confusion, a lot of hate. Hate for myself for not being able to prevent it, and hate for her for actually doing it, but I don't feel respect.
You remember how she used to say that a second of freedom is worth more than a lifetime of bondage?
Yeah.
She chose freedom. And you should respect her decision and admire her for being brave enough to follow through with it. It wasn't your kind of freedom or my kind of freedom, but it was hers.
Suicide isn't freedom.
If all you feel is pain, and there's nothing but drugs to make it go away, and your choice is either living as addict or going out on your own terms, there's only one choice, and that's going out.
How about the third choice, which is dealing with the pain?
Not everybody can do it.
I look away, shake my head, clench my jaw. Leonard speaks.
You ever heard of the 5 stages of grief?
I look back. No. What are they?
I don't know. I just heard of them. Saw something about them on some lady's show. I'm figuring you're going through them, and at some point, you'll agree with me.
Fuck you, Leonard. And fuck your 5 stages of grief. He laughs.
You want to get out of here?
Yeah. He motions for the check. When it arrives, I reach for it. He speaks.
What are you doing?
I'm getting it tonight. I reach into my pocket, get my cash.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
Unacceptable.
Not open to debate.
I pay for dinner. It's part of what I do.
Not tonight.
I have more money than you.
I look at the check, start counting money. You remember when you told me that when someone wants to do something nice for you, that you should just smile and say thank you?
That only applies when I'm doing something nice for you.
Smile and say thank you, Leonard. I put the cash in the check, close it. Leonard smiles.
Thank you, my son.
I stand. Let's go. Leonard stands. We leave. We take a cab north to meet my friends. We get out of the cab, walk into an old-time bowling alley pool hall. There are 3 rooms. One has a long oak bar lined with stools. The bar is probably 100 years old. Another has the bowling alley, 5 lanes, all of them manual. 2 men crouch at the end of the lanes and replace the pins when they fall and roll the balls back to the bowlers. The third room is large, open, has 12-foot ceilings. There are 10 pool tables in two lines of five that run the length of the room. Overhead lamps hang above each of the tables. Stools and bar tables line the edges of the room. Leonard and I walk into the pool room, look for my friends. They're standing around a table in the corner. We walk over to them. Though most of them have met him already, I introduce Leonard to everyone. He kisses each of the girls' hands, tells them they look beautiful. He shakes hands with the guys, says, "Nice to meet you, nice to see you again." When the introductions are over, he motions to the waitress, tells her to bring more of everything. Bring a pitcher of cola and two glasses, and keep it coming all night. Just keep it coming. We shoot pool. My friends drink. We smoke cigarettes. Leonard smokes a cigar. We laugh, laugh, laugh. We start shooting pool for money, $5-$10 a game. Leonard is a disaster, loses 3 games. The rest of us are more or less equal, split the games, split the money. When Leonard's not playing, he's dancing with the girls, twirling them around, teaching them fancy steps, lathering them with compliments. The night moves on. My friends get more drunk. My friend Kevin suggests we raise the stakes. We agree, raise them to 20 a game. Leonard starts playing again, destroys every single one of us, giggles to himself as he does it. I ask him what the fuck happened. He laughs, says he used to hustle pool and wanted to see if he could still do it. I laugh, say, "Yeah, you can still do it. Now stop. My friends aren't made of money." Leonard stops playing, gives everyone their money back, tells them he used to hustle pool for cash, offers each of us a couple of tips. He starts dancing with the girls again. My friend Scott, who is bombed, walks over to me. He looks pissed. He speaks. "You better tell your buddy to stop dancing with my girlfriend." He's harmless. "I don't like the way he's fucking dancing with her." I can promise you, he doesn't mean anything. I don't care. Tell him to fucking stop. Scott is a big man. 6'3", well over 200 pounds, and he has a bad temper. I know Leonard's not interested in his girlfriend, but I don't want any problems. I walk over to where Leonard and Scott's girlfriend, whose name is Jessica, are dancing. Scott follows me. "Leonard?" Leonard spins Jessica. "Leonard." Pulls her in, gives her a dip. "Leonard." He looks over at me.
"Just a second."
Scott steps around me. I try to stop him, but he pushes me off.
"Stop dancing with my girlfriend, motherfucker."
He pulls Jessica away. Jessica looks shocked. Leonard looks shocked.
"No offense here, friend. No offense.
I'll kick your fucking ass if you touch her again."
"You're misunderstanding the situation. I mean no disrespect."
Scott has no idea who Leonard is or what he does. Has no idea the problem he's about to create for himself. I step toward him. "You gotta calm down, Scott." He turns to me.
"Fuck you."
Turns to Leonard. "And fuck you. I will kick your ass if you so much as look at her again." People around have stopped playing, are watching.
"You should watch yourself, kid. That temper is going to get you into trouble."
"It's going to get you into trouble, old man."
Something in Leonard, who until now has been calm, changes. His face goes still, his eyes narrow, his body tenses. I have seen him like this before. Once when I first met him in rehab, the other time when we got in a fight with two of the other patients there, one of whom was later killed.
"You are making a big mistake, friend. You should turn now and leave."
Jessica starts pulling on Scott's arm and saying, "Come on, come on, let's go." Scott stares at Leonard.
"I'll fuck you up."
Leonard does not respond, just stares. Jessica pulls Scott away. They start walking toward the door. She's obviously upset. Looks like she's going to cry. I step toward Leonard. "Sorry about that."
"Your friend shouldn't drink so much."
He can get a bit out of control.
"Think I'm allowed to dance with the other girls?"
I laugh. "Yeah, I think you are."
"Good.
Let's get back to the good times. That's why I came. For the motherfucking good times.
I laugh. Leonard walks over to Adrian, asks her to dance. She says yes. I meet Leonard for breakfast. A late breakfast. We stayed out until 4. Leonard dancing with the girls, me shooting pool with the guys. Good times. Good times. Leonard asks me if I've spoken to Scott. I say no. I think it's best to leave it alone. He doesn't need to know about the potential consequences of his actions. Telling him would mean he would have to know what Leonard does for a living. Leonard agrees with me. We leave the hotel. The sun is out. It's bright, warm. The streets are crowded with happy people. Happy because winter is disappearing. Happy because it's the first nice day in months. We walk down Michigan Avenue, occasionally stopping to look into the windows of expensive stores. Leonard loves clothing. Loves expensive clothing. Loves tailored wool suits. Handmade shoes. Shirts made from Egyptian cotton. Silk ties. He says that most people don't like wearing suits and are uncomfortable in them because they buy shitty, cheap, ill-fitting suits made from poor materials. He says a properly cut suit, made from quality materials, is the most comfortable thing one can wear. I tell him I prefer jeans and a t-shirt, wool socks and combat boots. He laughs, says if you were my genetic son, you would think otherwise. We end up at the Art Museum, the Art Institute of Chicago. We walk through the galleries of European paintings. We move through them in chronological order. We see 6 Giovanni di Paolo altarpiece panels depicting St. John the Baptist, who looks like he's starving, wandering through a wasteland, his golden halo shining. We see a bright silvery El Greco of the Virgin ascending on a crescent moon. We see 8 gloomy Rembrandts, stern men in capes and feathered hats, staring into a black distance. We see desperate Rinaldo being enchanted by the sorceress Armida in her billowing shawl as painted by Tiepolo. We see Turner,